destination, Election Day.
To change the course.
We are not going back.
Roll with the station that keeps you informed. 55 KRC.
Get on the train.
The talk station. The 55 KRC, the talk station. Wednesday. Happy Wednesday.
I'm the dude, man.
And I'm Brian Thomas, and Joe Strucker, my executive producer, is also a present. Thank you, Joe, for lining up the show, as always. Of course, they say without Joe, the show don't go. And the show goes a lot better if you call in. Maybe you got a comment about something going on in the world. I got the CDC guidelines for Halloween, and I have an interesting FCC non-compliant response from Joe Strecker about what the Halloween police can do. Joe's a big fan of Halloween. You'll be messing with Joe's Halloween. What's coming up in the program before we dive on into what's going on in the world, including the CDC guidelines to keep you well? Yeah, they're here to help you. Jeffrey Sakanga, he's an Empower You. He's going to be doing an Empower You seminar tonight. Really great one, too. You definitely want to get in touch with his virtual class. Thomas Jefferson, Saint or Sinner. If you were listening to the 55 KRC Morning Show yesterday, we had Dan Reginald, who's the owner of Frame USA and responsible for creating Empower You. They'll be opening the Empower You studios at some point during this semester, which lasts all the way through the end of November, if I recall correctly. But the link to all the EmpowerYouOhio.org is the website, but that's on my blog page as well. You can find that. But this one is really going to be interesting because, of course, in these current crazy times we live in, people are obviously seeking to rewrite history and tear down the brilliant folks in spite of their flaws. And I mean, who let he who is without sin cast the first stone? Who among us can cast a stone? What we can point to is his political legacy. The genius that Thomas Jefferson exhibited in the documents, in the words that he wrote, and the foundation to allow us to build the greatest nation that has ever been, that has ever been in existence in the world's history, at least insofar as the gifts that we have given to the world, the number of people we've been able to save, the resources that we have allocated, the money that we have made, and everything that good that has flown or that flowed from it, including for all the green folks out there who think that, you know, all this capitalism's bad. Listen, before the country became wealthy, you know, I think about the old pollution dumping sites. You know, it's you went out in your backyard of the factory and you just poured the stuff into the ground, whatever that stuff might be. And then years later, CERCLA, they passed the cleanup legislation and then mandated all these companies go and clean up the grounds that they had soiled over the years. And fine, you can't get to that point and force all these businesses to clean up what the mess they made until there's enough money laying around. Yeah, well, that's capitalism. Capitalism creates the engine, is the money-making aspect by which all of this flows, all the social good and social welfare programs, and it all flows from us making money. That's the beautiful thing that we were given here, a free society, thanks to Jefferson and the Founding Fathers, a free society. And for those that wasn't free for black people, you're right. You're absolutely right. And thank God we evolved in this free society. And our Constitution, which seems unequivocal insofar as people, yes, everyone, black, white, yellow, red, green, whatever, everyone's supposed to enjoy the freedoms. Yeah, we didn't allow that at the outset of our country. The world was a much different place. But it was the genius, the foundation that allowed freedom to ultimately flow, and it has, and it is. Take advantage of it. I know there's still problems in society, but without this foundational principles that he was so critical in creating, you couldn't have the freedoms that we enjoy, regardless of the color of your skin. Janice Heisel joins the program at 7:40, local author. The book, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader Mary Jo Cropper and Her Legacy of Hope. Always enjoy talking about the wonderful research that's going in. And soon we're going to have a cure for cancer. I always like to say that. Optimistic I am. Ilya Shapiro with the book Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Perfect timing for that one. Thanks, Joe. And following Ilya Shapiro at 8:05, we'll hear from Judge Anna Napolitano on, yes, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Supreme Court. And finally, this ought to be great, Patrick Kanan, the Grub Pub. I guess is he the owner of the Grub Pub, Joe? Family owns it? Family owned and operated business? Well, Patrick Kanan happens to be one of the family members that owns the Grub Pub, one of the restaurants / bars that were fined for an after 10 p.m. drink. Oh, heaven forbid. Because, you know, you drink after 10. We all know it. Governor DeWine said it. Drink after 10, you're going to get coronavirus. And if you Halloween, if you trick-or-treat, you're going to get it as well. All right. The CDC released its guidelines on Halloween, taking the wind out of Joe Strecker's sails. Will Joe Strecker pursue low-risk activities? Will he pursue moderate-risk activities? Or will he go all out with the list of higher-risk activities? What do they say you're allowed to do? You can carve or decorate a pumpkin with your family member. You got to be all right. You can carve or decorate pumpkins outside at a safe distance with neighbors or friends. I have to also note that you're allowed to go grocery shopping, and there's no restriction on that. You can decorate your house, your apartment, or living space. A Halloween scavenger hunt is on the low-risk activities. Children given a list of Halloween-themed things to look for while they walk outdoors from house to house, admiring Halloween decorations at a distance. No candy collection in that one, Joe. Just admire the Halloween decorations at a distance. Have a virtual Halloween costume contest. That makes my head hurt thinking about that one. Are you serious? You're going to have an 8-year-old kid who's really all ginned up with excitement to go trick-or-treating? Oh, here, look, there's your friends in the video screen. Look, it's virtual. Are you having fun now? Billy's dressed as a policeman. And little Jane's dressed as an Antifa. Look at him go. Have a Halloween movie night with only the people you live with. Have a scavenger hunt style trick or treat search with your household members in and around your home rather than going house to house. All right, kids, we got a game for you. Halloween, we're going to pick up the house. It's all that laundry on the floor of your bedroom, pick that up. That's check on the list. Check. You get a Snickers for that, right? And then you get an extra one, and these are miniature Snickers, not the full-size ones. You get an extra one if you take that laundry and put it in the washing machine. It doesn't say you have to wash the candy if you are giving it within your household, Joe. So go to Kroger's and socially mingle with every other human being on the planet. Buy your candy, bring it home, and then hide in your house. And don't go out. Moderate risk activities. We're moving on to the list here. Participating in one-way trick-or-treating where individually wrapped goodie bags are lined up for families to grab and go while continuing to social distance. Like, for example, they say, at the end of the driveway or the edge of the yard. Now, anybody remember having a house that just had the candy bucket outside the door in years past? And did you ever come upon that bucket and it was completely empty? So some punk kid came up and dumped the entire bucket into his or her bag. That was you, Joe, right? That was you. It was you. You were the what? He took all the pennies as well, Joe. There's a special place in hell for you. But if you're putting it all at the end of the driveway, you just turn around. You're going in to watch your movie with your close family members because it's now Halloween movie night. You put all the candy at the end of the driveway. How long is it going to last? Just saying. Practical considerations to be addressed here. Having a small group, outdoor, open-air costume parade where people are distanced more than 6 feet. You're walking around in a circle. Attending a costume party held outdoors where protective masks are used and people can remain more than 6 feet apart. So that's just exactly like going to the grocery store. You should have just one thing here. Anything you can do at a grocery store is A-OK for Halloween. Use your imagination. going to an open-air, one-way walk-through haunted forest where appropriate mask use is enforced and people can remain more than 6 feet apart. Do you know any one-way walk-through haunted forests, Joe? Is there like a haunted forest around here? I know they claim there are haunted houses. I don't believe in ghosts anyway, so this is all much ado about nothing. But, I mean, if the CDC's got the list, they must have at least one in mind. Let's see here. Visiting pumpkin patches or orchards where people use hand sanitizer before touching the pumpkins? I thought food was not a problem here. And, in fact, even in the CDC guidelines, they mentioned food. It is not an issue, and that at least you're not going to, well, here, in the same CDC guidelines, quote, currently there is no evidence to suggest that handling food or eating is associated with directly spreading COVID-19. So why in the hell would you have to go to a pumpkin farm that washes their pumpkins with hand sanitizer? If you can't contract it from food, you can't contract it from a pumpkin. Having an outdoor Halloween movie night with local family friends with people spaced at least 6 feet apart. If sub point on that one, you ready? And this is a sub point on a couple of them. If screaming will likely occur, greater distancing is advised. Just doing a face palm right now. The terrorists have won. Okay, here's the high-risk activity short list. Avoid these higher-risk activities to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. Participating in traditional trick-or-treating where treats are handed to children who go door-to-door. This is like the cashier at the grocery store returning your change to you. You're right there. You're that close. Look at them. You can touch them. They're so close, they put change in your hand. Do that every day. This is also high risk, having trunk or treat where treats are handed out from trunks of cars lined up in parking lots. Well, that's a rather broad brush. If your cars are lined up in parking lots and they're 6 feet apart, I think you'll be okay, wouldn't it? Attending crowded costume parties held indoors, going to an indoor haunted house where people may be crowded together and screaming. Going on hay rides or tractor rides with people who are not in your household. Using alcohol or drugs. They say that can cloud judgment and increase risky behaviors. Well, I mean, that's why a lot of people take drugs and alcohol, I thought. Remember college? Anyway. Finally, traveling to a rural fall festival that is not in your community if you live in an area with community spread of COVID-19. So having a go at the efforts in the rural climes. I guess it's okay then to go to an urban fall festival? Just asking. 518-55-CARE-CD, Talk Station, 749-5500-800-823-TALK, #550 on AT&T phones. Got to mention Goodwill. I love what station. More choice FCC non-compliant response from Joe Strecker insofar as the CDC Halloween guidelines are concerned. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, #550 on AT&T phones. John, welcome to the program, sir. It's good to have you on this morning.
Thanks, Mr. Thomas. I and my wife have just about had it up to here with the mandates and this and that. Now they're talking about, we are talking about trick-or-treating guidelines and grocery shopping guidelines. And is any of this stuff, is it a law? Like, legally you can get in trouble if you defy these guidelines?
No. I think legally, and, you know, I'm going by a lot of the court cases, but I'm also going by the fact that CDC, federal, you know, nationwide kind of thing, they have no control over you. If they could control you on a federal level, this is where states' rights comes in. This is where the Constitution limits the federal government's authority, even though in spite of the fact that we have a federal government that has grown so big, we can't even pay for it anymore. But they can't issue a mandate across the great land of ours, like, for example, for a mask. All they can do is provide, and they call them this, guidelines. So you can feel free to disregard them. I would think the one area where you could literally get in trouble, you could be sued, is if you know you have the disease. And this would be the case with anything that's communicable. If you have a communicable disease and you're aware of it, if you knowingly, intentionally spread it and maybe even negligently spread it, because if you've got it, you shouldn't be mingling with other people, that you could get sued for spreading it to someone or giving it to someone. So that would be the case, like if you had HIV or a sexually transmitted disease. You give it to somebody else, you can be criminally charged for that, I believe, but certainly civilly, gone after civilly.
That makes sense.
So, you know, there's, I guess, legitimate points to be made insofar as not spreading germs generally. These CDC guidelines could be applied throughout every single day of our life, because there's always a cold or flu or something communicable, right?
So, Yes, sir.
John, be careful. And I'm surprised you and your wife are only now getting to the point where you've had enough, because I've been there for a while.
No. I mean, it's to the breaking point now. I've been there for months. And she's a hairdresser, so she was out for a couple of months. And, you know, and a lot of people wanted her to come to their houses and cut their hair. And, I will give it to her. She stuck to her guns and followed the rules, you know, and had to fight it out to get the unemployment. And she did. I think she ended up getting like 6 weeks of the 10 weeks that she wasn't allowed to work paid. But
well, that's good. I'll tell you what, on the cutting hair at home, remember, they threatened to pull the cosmetology licenses for folks who did that, because that was one of the things. If you cut hair at home, we're going to pull your ticket.
That's why she wouldn't do it.
Yeah,
she was,
I understand.
Absolutely petrified. It took her 25 years to build her business book, and if she didn't have a license, you know, she'd be starting all over at 45 years old. I mean, you can't, you know, do that to somebody. But
I get it, but you know what? Ultimately, I think that rule was probably unconstitutional as well, or rather, it didn't have there wasn't the appropriate legislative authority to do that. Again, I keep going back to the law on the books in Ohio is for sick people. You know, if your wife's not sick, then she, as far as I'm concerned, can cut hair. You should ever listen to, ever tune in at 8:45 or you can to Patrick Kane, the owner of the Grub Pub, because he and his family got fined for serving alcohol after 10. Oh,
I will.
Crimes against humanity, John.
Love that. Yeah, yep. We always have a drink at 10:01 at my house.
I would too if I was awake. You too, John. Stay well. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, #550 on the AT&T phones. Odor Exit, what a great product Odor Exit is. It gets rid of. It is 5:31 right now. I've got local stories in front of me. Dive on into those. We got a little snowflake problem here, Joe Strecker. University of Cincinnati professor has been accused of, heaven forbid, referring to the COVID-19 as the Chinese virus. This person now on administrative leave with pay. Email sent to adjunct instructor. His name's John Euchre. UC's College of Engineering and Applied Sciences, Dean John Wiedner, wrote that Euchre's courses will be handled by another faculty member for the time being. As you are aware, he wrote, A, as in one singular student in one of your classes or one of your courses has raised concern regarding one of your emails. This matter has been referred to UC's Office of Equal Opportunity and Access for review. As such, effective immediately, you're being placed on administrative leave with pay pending the outcome of the review. His full cooperation with the OEAO is both expected and appreciated, it said in the email. They began an investigation after a third-year engineering student named Evan Sotzing, who's 20, posted an email he received from Euchre on social media. The email came after Sotzing had missed a lab session due to being quarantined for possible exposure to coronavirus. The email reads, quote, "For students testing positive for the Chinese virus, I will give no grade. You can read the info I sent to the class regarding the torsion test," close quote. And, of course, he had to repost that on social media. He went on Twitter, where he had over 37,500 retweets, more than 166,500 likes as of Tuesday morning when this email went out on the prior Friday. Don't we have anything better to do than society than just retweet crap? He asked rhetorically. Stotzing, speaking with the Enquirer.
Nobody cares.
Yeah. I think the school should take disciplinary actions against the professor because his actions completely violate the school's values. Really? Stutzig said he's not clear whether Euchre's message meant he was getting a zero grade if the professor merely not grading the assignment. Well, you need to send an email back saying, I'm confused by your email's lack of clarity, sir. What does this mean? He says he was offended by what he called racist language from Euchre in the email and the notion that Euchre might punish the student for adhering to national and state and local health guidelines. This Wiedner guy who sent the email to the professor telling him he was going to be on administrative leave, Wiedner confirmed that the matter was referred to that reviewing board. The department handles inquiries regarding discrimination, harassment, retaliation based on disability, race, color, religion, national origin, or other identities. Wiedner wrote to the Enquirer, quote, these types of xenophobic comments and stigmatizations around location or ethnicity are more than troubling. We can better protect and care for all when we speak about COVID-19 with both accuracy and empathy, something we should all strive for. All right. According to Euchre's personnel file, he's been at the university since 1996. In a letter sent in August, states Euchre was offered an adjunct professor position in the College of Engineering and Applied Sciences effective August 24th through December 12th. He isn't paid enough, though. $3,600. Wow. We have come unhinged and unglued in this society. Where did the virus come from, Joe? Is it China, right? Is it Wuhan province, China? It's Trump's fault. No, it's Trump. Oh, Trump created the virus and spread it. Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right. I should probably pay a little closer attention to CNN. Got Stack of Stupid coming up. If you want to comment, I'd love to hear from you, though. 749-5500, 800-823, talk, pound 550 on AT&T phone. See, I just seem to have this recollection of last December. Coming up on 541 right now, 55 KRCD Talk Station. And, of course, this hour, or this time of the hour, 5 o'clock hour, it's time for the Stack of Stupid. No callers being online. Let's dive on into it. If you're searching for ways to kill your significant other, I guess the cops can figure that one out. There's an Indiana woman who's believed to have murdered her husband by having him consume toxic amounts of poisonous mushrooms and then dumping his body in a ditch. Katrina Fouts, who should have just walked away, 54 years old, Pendleton, and Terry Hopkins, 64, charged with murder in the death of David Fouts, who was 50, this according to the Indianapolis Star. David found dead in a ditch April 24th of this year. His wife never reported him missing. There's a red flag. It had been several days since anyone had seen him alive. Autopsy, apparent murder victim, later found chunks of mushrooms in his stomach, which determined to be toxic and poisonous. According to the Hamilton County Coroner, speaking with the Indianapolis Star, there was a poisonous agent in his stomach that, if untreated, will produce death. Officials said in an affidavit they discovered the searches in Katrina's cell phone. Here you go. Here's the smoking gun. Searches on Katrina's cell phone about, poisonous mushrooms and inquiries about overdosing on medications.
Just walk away.
No word of whether she searched hiring a hitman. The mushrooms tested positive for muscarine, which is described as a naturally occurring toxic poison found in certain varieties of deadly mushroom. It's usually here's the key thing. Maybe she thought she could get away with it. Usually undetectable after about 3 days. In this case, examiners were able to determine the poison's presence through the mushroom chunks. Not clear if David Fouts was force-fed or was given the poison mushrooms to eat under false pretenses. However, his corpse was found with various cuts to his hands at the time of the discovery. I think that suggests maybe he wasn't really interested in eating them. Family friend and former police officer Terry Hopkins also charged with aiding in the murder of David Fouts. According to local WWLP, no motive been given for the toxic-based killing, but Katrina was charged last week for her alleged role in the poison mushroom murder. Prosecutors also alleged they discovered DNA evidence on David Fouts' body that tied his wife to the slaying. Yeah, her lawyer should probably try to cop a plea to reduce it down to a lesser sentence or something. I don't think that one's going anywhere. Oh, boy. Did you put this one in here to see if I do a Ron Burgundy, Joe? I don't think I can read that one. Every once in a while, Strecker throw me a curveball, and it's an article that contains language which might not pass FCC compliance, and I can't dance around that one. That's the whole thing surrounding a mock-up of the Joe Biden Kamala Harris yard sign, and there's a little phrase going on out there, and I don't think it will be appropriate for me to get down that road.
Come on, man.
All right. San Antonio, Texas, for this one, a former teacher at San Antonio says she was fired after she declined to stop wearing a Black Lives Matter face mask at school. Interesting twist. Lillian White, I thought we were crucifying people for refusing to wear Black Lives Matter paraphernalia. Oh, that's right. It is Texas. Former teacher at Great Western Hills Charter School. Reported White began attending weekly in-person training sessions at Great Hearts Western Hills in July, wearing homemade masks printed with the phrases Black Lives Matter and Silence is Violence. She's spoken with the news. For about a week and a half, I was wearing these masks and no one said anything. A couple of other teachers came up and asked for someone if I had any extra, and I made them some. She said she received a text message from the assistant principal saying, "We'd like you to stop wearing these masks. Parents will be coming around more, and we don't discuss the current political climate." So remain politically neutral, the recommendation from the assistant principal, which seems to me to be the best ground to trot upon. Anyway, even then, White says she continued wearing the mask, citing her commitment to what Black Lives Matter stands for. Do you think she's been to the BlackLivesMatter.com website? Do you think she knows that they're anti-family and Marxist and all about, well, actually, I could say that up until about 2 days ago when BlackLivesMatter.com pulled the sheet on their website. It's no longer there, at least that's what I read yesterday, describing who they are and what they believe in. Anyway, email statement from the school. Great Heart respects the privacy of all current and former employees and as a result does not issue public comment on the specific personnel matters. On the question related to the face coverings, Great Hearts enacted, and in this unprecedented pandemic environment, a policy that face coverings have no external messages. This policy was authored by school leaders and teachers in serving the learning environment of our classroom. So there was a rule, and I guess she violated it. 546 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station, 749-5500, 800-823-TALK. It's 551, 55 KRC, the talk station. It is Wednesday, and happy Wednesday to you. Judge Anna Napolitano at 8:30. Make sure you're on for that. We'll talk about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the Supreme Court replacement. Okay, cancel culture is alive and well. Go back to the stack of stupid where Costco has stopped carrying products from a pimento cheese brand owned by South Carolina mayor who called the Black Lives Matter and Antifa movements terror organizations. Mayor of Pawleys Island, Brian Henry, owner of Palmetto Cheese, speaking with the Georgetown Times, that the company's products were being pulled as a matter of normal business. That's in quotes. I guess that's what they told him. Wholesale retailer rotating items out regularly. Yeah, Liam's got it right. So we remain optimistic that Palmetto Cheese will be back on the shelves in the not-too-distant future. When reached for comment, Costco representative denied the comment on the Palmetto Cheese brand. Georgetown Times published a photo of a sign in the Myrtle Beach Costco store stating that the products were, quote, discontinued and will not be reordered by Costco, close quote, adding that the products were being removed from more than 120 locations. Palmetto facing calls from a boycott from some customers following his controversial Facebook post in which he tied the protest movements to the unrelated fatal shooting of a father and daughter following an auto crash. The victims were white, the accuser killer is black. Georgetown chapter of the NAACP called Henry's post racist and called for him to resign. Since deleted the post, publicly apologized, of course, calling his comments harmful and insensitive. Also asked people calling for the boycott to reconsider. He says, hey, please consider the hundreds of South Carolina jobs that depend on its success. Palmetto Cheese parenthetically sold at more than 9,100 stores in 44 states and Washington, D.C. How about that? Don't they sell that at your local grocery store, too, not just Costco? I think so. Not for long, I guess. Stock up, because apparently it's going to be leaving the shelves. Here's an interesting twist on a driving school operator. Lawrence Mann, who owns a driving school in North Andover, could be Michigan. No, this is Boston. Arrested Friday on allegations that he was running a large-scale methamphetamine operation. Michael LaRocque.
What?
56 years old, arrested at home on Friday. Investigators executed a search warrant at his residence, which he apparently owns. About 2 pounds of methamphetamine seized at his home, plus, quote, vials of an unknown liquid and paraphernalia related to narcotics distribution, close quote. More methamphetamine found in his car parked at the home. Search of the auto school allegedly turned up more meth, 400 grams worth, along with pills and $12,000 in cash. All right, let's go to an airline flight. British man. A British man who was denied an alcoholic drink aboard a flight to Palma de Mallorca because he was too drunk, at least they concluded that, went on a rampage. 29-year-old first tried to open a refrigerator containing booze and then swipe a drink from another passenger before the flight from Birmingham touched down at Palma's airport on the Spanish island. While members of the Civil Guard spoke to a crew about the man's actions, a fight broke out in the cabin. According to the statement from the Civil Guard, as officers were taking down details of what occurred by the entrance of the plane, we saw the fight had broken out inside. They entered the aircraft and saw the detainee attacking another passenger. Here we go. After biting off part of his right ear.
Just walk away.
He was overpowered and arrested. Injured passenger described as the drunken suspect's friend, taken to a local hospital for treatment. Officers were hurt in a scuffle. A suspect charged with alleged offense causing injury hasn't been named. Airline has not been identified. Civil Guard in a statement said it was responsible for security and public order at all the facilities of the restricted area, the airports, as well as inside the aircraft before arrival and departure. It was his friend? He said Mike Tyson, yeah, but the guy whose ear he bit off, you couldn't say that was Mike Tyson's friend. Former friend? So 5:56, we've got more to talk about, including the bat crap insanity exists all over the world. What did you hear what New York City is doing in the name of bat crap insanity? We'll get to that right off the top of the hour news. I hope you can stick around.
Folks, have you seen all of the hubbub?
To stop the spread of misinformation, a rush mandate has been issued.
Why not?
Today at noon on 55KRC.
It's 6:05, the 55KRC Talk Station. Happy Wednesday. Brian Thomas right here. Glad to be. Got a phone number if you'd like to call. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, or #550 on AT&T phones. Call it a number. It's one central bank of phones. So all three, basically the same thing in my mind. If you call, we'll take your call. Coming up, bottom of the hour, Jeffrey Sakenga. He's doing an Empower You seminar. That's tonight. You should check it out. It's online. It's easy to log in, empoweryouohio.org. Thomas Jefferson, saint or sinner. The idea that we're even having this discussion is kind of unusual to me, but Jeffrey's going to dive on into that. We'll hear from him at the bottom of this hour, followed by, at 7:40, Janice Heisel, local author, has a new book, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader Mary Jo Cropper and Her Legacy of Hope. So a little inspiring book, and that's a great thing to have in these dark times we live in. A little inspiration. Ilya Shapiro with the book Supreme Disorder. This at 8:05. Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations in the Politics of America's Highest Court. Good timing on that one, I'd say, with Donald Trump announcing on this Saturday who his Supreme Court justice pick is going to be, and then off to the races. Judge Napolitano on the same topic, Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg passing, and keep looking in your Constitution for that clause that says the dying wish of a Supreme Court justice counts and matters and means anything. Joe and I were talking about that off air. Joe is of the mind in this coronavirus times that very sick, frail people aren't allowed to have visitors when they're in a hospital. We've heard stories in all kinds, like family members having to stand outside windows and waving at their lonely loved ones from behind the quarantine glass, and all for the name of keeping someone healthy. Joe actually is questioning, based upon that, whether she really said that it was her dying wish that the next president choose her replacement. Healthy skepticism, Joe, is that what that is? And then he had also read someplace, and I didn't see this myself. Maybe you did. You can call up and verify or not, that she was actually in a coma when she passed away, which makes, I don't know, maybe she uttered her dying wish last week. Who knows? Anyway, it's not in the Constitution. And she also is one that said she was not in favor of packing the court. So if we're going to take her words to heart, why don't we do that one? And she did swear to uphold the Constitution when she took her oath of office. And since she swears to uphold the Constitution specifically provides for the replacement or the naming and approval of a Supreme Court justice, there you go. Anyhow, Ilya Shapiro on that. And then Judge Napolitano, of course, on Ruth Bader Ginsburg and SCOTUS. And then I'm looking forward to having Patrick Kanan on the phone at 8:45 because he was cited, he and his family, I guess, owners of the Grub Pub, cited for violating Governor DeWine's random edict about serving alcohol after 10 o'clock. So citations, and that's how they're going after you. They're going after your licenses. They're not going to prosecute you criminally because they couldn't. There's no law on the books. But because there's an edict out there based on nothing, and in fact, the edicts have been deemed already by multiple courts in Ohio to be unconstitutional, I think Patrick's got a good argument. If he ever goes into court and fights this, maybe Patrick will let us know if he's planning on lawyering up and challenging this citation. Please, Patrick, do that. I can only keep my fingers crossed for something like that. Has to be challenges to this nonsense. Oh, and we lost another Trump voter over the break. Joe Strecker heard that Cindy McCain is now backing Joe Biden. Widow of John McCain. Y'all know John. That just put Joe right over the edge. Sitting there, who cares what Cindy McCain's going to do one way or the other? Does she think she's still holding the chip on her husband's chip on her shoulder? Is she keeping that... She's keeping that one alive. Oh, Mike's on the phone with a comment about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So let's take that before I tell you what's going on in New York. Bat crap insanity is the only way I can sum it up. Hey, Mike, welcome to the program and happy Wednesday to you.
Hi, Brian. Happy Wednesday to you and happy belated birthday.
Oh, thanks, man. Appreciate that.
About Ruth Bader Ginsburg wanting her last dying wish. She wanted to replace her after a new president comes in. Like, so she wants us to wait 4 years to get a new Supreme Court justice.
Oh.
If Trump wins, but what she wants is another, maybe another 4 years before her replacement.
Right, right. I know. Some have commented that it was she should have stepped down during the Obama administration to ensure that her seat would be replaced by, well, Barack Obama. I think she probably was duped into believing, like everybody else was, the polling information that Hillary Clinton was going to walk away with that one. I think she was just holding on so Hillary Clinton could replace her. And that was her strategy, and I believe that was probably everybody's strategy, given how frail health she was, and, of course, with the cancer diagnosis. But yeah,
she's been on life support for a while, so, I mean,
yeah, I know.
Think they're trying to figure, like, we wait just enough, you know, they don't have enough time to get somebody into the election, so she died.
Yeah, that's that. One thing for sure, we know that. Mike, good to hear from you, my friend. Stay well. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK. Over to New York. Okay, why are restaurants in New York closed? Because the governor forced them closed, right? It was either the governor or the mayor. Either way, they're closed. So what do you need to do? Yes, politicians who close the restaurants are now going to pass legislation to try to stave them. They're considering, and there's multiple bills they're considering, and this is just insane. The idea is to aid restaurants seeking to recover from the economic hit heaped down upon them because of random and arbitrary edicts from our elected officials. Mayor Bill de Blasio, back in July, announced that the Open Restaurants Program, initial cap on that, would be extended to October 31st. This is the Open Restaurants Program is the one that allows, and that becomes an important word, the program allows, meaning there is otherwise there's a prohibition. So you had, because there's a prohibition on the book, they had to pass the Open Restaurants Program that allows restaurants and bars to expand outdoor seating and sidewalks, city streets, parking lots, in order to increase in revenue while maintaining social distance guidelines. So prohibition, there's no outdoor dining. You know, you're not able to take over that space, restaurant owner. So that needs to be dealt with. So they passed the open restaurants legislation, which says, okay, now you can. So they had to pass another one that it's going to be extended now, or Bill de Blasio announced that it was going to be extended, whether it's pursuant to some legislative act or he just said, oh, we're going to extend it unilaterally. So they're going to continue to allow this outdoor dining. Now, as part of legislation, this second piece of legislation introduced by City Councilman Antonio Reynoso. Restaurants and bars will be allowed, suggesting there's a prohibition, and there is, will be allowed to use propane heaters. Those are banned currently in New York City. Can't have a propane heater. I don't know, is that in the name of global warming or just general safety? Because there are all kinds of places around Cincinnati that have propane heaters. They're everywhere. Why would you ban them? We have a Consumer Product Safety Commission that makes sure that all those products that are put out in the world aren't harmful to you and aren't going to do you any harm, but no, not in New York City. I have a feeling they probably banned them simply because of global warming. Okay, much like they have stopped banning plastic bags, Chris Seelbach, because we need the plastic disposable bags in times of COVID-19, the green stuff, the environment, gets to take a pause while we all deal with a more urgent circumstance, the pandemic. See, everything should be viewed that way. Our economy is going down the toilet. All right, let's pause the Green New Deal funding and wealth redistribution for a while because we have more important problems on our hands, more pressing needs. Anyway, so propane heaters. Department of Transportation, this is a thank you for the Wall Street Journal giving me this information. Department of Transportation in New York will also be required to set up an online application process that restaurants can use to certify their establishments for outdoor dining. Certification? Do you think New York would come to a complete standstill? No one would be employed if New York didn't have so many regulations and rules and in little minions running around having to enforce them or otherwise process paperwork. This city councilman, Antonio Reynoso, also said in an interview that outdoor heating systems will help restaurants adhere to safety measures in colder months if they aren't able to expand indoor dining at full capacity, because currently it's limited to 25. Well, actually, it's limited to 25%. Or I'm sorry, it's limited at all now. You can't go in a restaurant in New York. September 30th, they're allowed to let people back inside the restaurant doors, but only at 25% capacity. Currently, they only allow pickup and outdoor dining at restaurants. So they're going to create outdoor heating systems. Yeah, that's prudent. That's wise. Oh, we got a nice warm building in there. Look all the chairs. Look at all the tables. I can see people, the diners and the patrons that want to go inside with their faces and hands pressed up against the window, looking in at the warm environment, the welcoming restaurant environment. Please, dear God, let me in there. I'm freezing my butt off out here. Not enough propane heaters in the world to heat up the entire outside of New York City in the middle of winter. Reynoso, this council person, said that it's unclear how the safety of the propane heaters will be regulated, but the city council is going to discuss the details of that in another review of the bill. That'll take place today. So, they're banned. We're going to let you have them back. Another law passed. And then we're going to pass a regulation to regulate your use of the heaters while we're letting you use them.
Make the rules, ma'am. I just think them up and write them down.
Think they're inspired. Reynoso had this to say, we don't want businesses waiting for the fire department of New York to show up and approve a permit for heating, which could take several months. That's the normal process, people. This is New York. This is the problem with government micromanagement and the need that they think you need to be protected. Save me from myself. Please, dear God, I can't be trusted. No one can be trusted with a propane heater outside. We need the fire department. It'll take them several months to give us a permit. And you know what? That permit will magically transform us into a responsible person that is capable of running a blanket propane heater from that point forward. No permit, no trust there. You don't think there's money to be made in all this permit issuing, do you? Actually, it gets worse. There are a couple of other bills. Got about a time in the segment, though. 617 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station. Foreign exchange. Wonderful folks at Foreign Exchange, ASC certified master technicians fixing your imported car, whether it's Asian or European. Asian is the preferred nomenclature, dude. But if you got a car from the Asian area, you got a car from Europe, if it came from over there, Foreign Exchange is the place to take it here because you'll get a full warranty on parts and services. They have data access to all of the manufacturer's technical information, and they're wonderfully accomplished mechanics at Foreign Exchange. I trust them with my cars, and we have for a long, long time, years. Austin and his team at the Westchester location, wonderful mechanics they are. That's where we go. It happens to be the most convenient location for my wife and me. But foreignx.com, foreignx.com for all the locations and the hours of operation and phone numbers. If you want to go to the Westchester location, and I recommend it, 644-2626 is the 622, 55 Care City Talk Station. Happy Wednesday to you. You're back over to New York. Okay, so they put all these impediments that are in place, and then because of coronavirus, of course, the restaurants are shut. And they have to pass special legislation to relieve the restaurant owners of the burden that was already on them based upon all this heavy regulation. For example, having to go to the fire department to get a waiver or a permit to have a heating unit there outdoors. And several months is what they say it could have taken. Last week, City Council in New York approved legislation allowing restaurants to add a 10% COVID-19 relief fee to your bill. And I joked about that last week when I first read about it, is because how come you need approval to do that? You're the owner of the restaurant. You set the prices, don't you? If you want to raise your prices 10% to cover the cost of coronavirus, well, then go ahead and do it. No, you need legislative approval for that. Councilman Ben Kallos expected to introduce two additional bills today. The idea of supporting small businesses in the pandemic. First one will streamline the process for restaurants to obtain a sidewalk cafe license or renew one if it was previously approved. Streamline the process because it's too blank and difficult. We need special legislation. The bill would also allow for licenses to be transferred to the establishment undergoes a change of ownership. I guess they're anticipating, yes, businesses going out. And the Wall Street Journal reporting that of the 2,800 small businesses the city closed between March and July, 1,289 of them were restaurants. They also plan to introduce a bill establishing low-interest small grants and loans program, providing restaurants with up to $250,000 in funds, ready, to bring their restaurants into regulatory compliance with the Americans with Disability Act. God. Skeeter, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Brian.
What's on your mind today?
Happy birthday.
Oh, thanks very much. Appreciate that.
I've been listening to you talking about New York City and its restaurants and so forth, and I was just curious. I haven't heard. Have they limited the bureaucracy to 25% capacity?
They should. I would get around in my head around that bill, Skeeter. Maybe you should suggest that one. I love that. Oh, my. You know, can you find any sanity in this? No. Good. Time to take a broader examination of government power and influence. Generally speaking, thank you, coronavirus, for bringing all of this to more people's attention, something I've been talking about for years and years. Our lives are micromanaged by a bunch of bureaucrats that don't know jack squat about what we do, our businesses, or anything else for that matter. Skeeter, take care of yourself, and thanks for the well wishes. I appreciate it. Sean Hannity Morning Update coming up in a moment. We're going to hear from Jeff Sikang. 6:30 right now, coming up on 6:31 at 55 Care CD Talk Station. A very happy Wednesday to you, and welcome Jeffrey Sikanga. He's Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center and Professor of Political Science at Ashland University. He has been at Ashland and connected with the Ashbrook Center since 97. Ashland University, Jeff served as President and Vice President of the Faculty Senate and was Chair of the Search Committee for the Provost of the University. He's a Senior Fellow in the Program on Constitution and Democracy at the University of Virginia. Been a visiting scholar at Stanford University's Hoover Institution and William E. Simon Distinguished Visiting Professor at the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine University. Famous for lecturing all over and a man who knows a whole lot about Thomas Jefferson. Welcome to the program, Jeff. It's a real pleasure to have you on today.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for doing this Empower Youth Seminar. We appreciate Dan Reginald of Frame USA for creating the whole concept, and he's been putting these sort of hosting these various topic events now for 10 years, and we're in the new semester for the fall. People can log on virtually at empoweruohio.org. Tonight at 7 p.m. is when it starts. You're going to hear Jeff talking about Thomas Jefferson, saint or sinner. Jeff, does it surprise you we're even having to have this conversation about the sinning component of Thomas Jefferson, given everything he did for our country and the world, I should argue?
Yeah, opinions really changed about Thomas Jefferson. He used to be loved by all Americans. You look back in the mid-20th century, we built the Jefferson Memorial to him out in Washington, D.C. People of both parties love Jefferson, but the tide of opinion has changed as people have been informed and maybe misinformed about Jefferson's views.
Well, I mean, he even identified the documents he wanted to be remembered by, none of which relate to maybe some of the more negative characteristics of his life. And I guess when you're talking about negative characteristics and the idea that you could characterize Thomas Jefferson as a sinner, are we really just talking, or not maybe just, I don't want to negate the subject or minimize it, but the fact that he was, in fact, a slave owner, Jeff? Is that it, or is there more about Jefferson that maybe we don't know?
Well, that's really the main point of it. Yeah, that's right. And the big difference between Jefferson and a lot of other slaveholders, as you know, and your listeners know, a lot of people at the time of the American founding, where slavery was legal in all of the colonies, held slaves. But the big difference is that Jefferson held slaves, but he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And people have been looking at that and saying, is that a contradiction? And some people are siding on the side of, yes, it is, and that makes him our original sinner.
Okay, and explain how it can be a contradiction. I know the words in the Declaration of Independence stand on their own merit, and you can read them, and it would suggest that all men and all human beings are to be uniform under the law. So there's no disparate treatment between people. You know, we're all equally treated in this country. Black people not included because the law said so. Jeff, how do you reconcile that?
Yeah, that's a great point. It became a big issue even in our American Civil War. So Americans have been talking about that and thinking about that for a long time. You know, in defense of Jefferson, he wrote publicly and privately against slavery. And a lot of people have said, what's more important and interesting, a slaveholder, a person who argued for against slavery but held slaves, which is what a lot of people think today, or is it that he was a slaveholder, yet he was anti-slavery? And there's really no question that Jefferson was in principle anti-slavery. He never defended the institution, but yet he continued to hold slaves. And that's the contradiction people want to understand about him.
Yeah, and I get that. It's the whole do as I say, not as I do thing. A lot of governors are guilty of this of late. You know, they can get their hair cut, but we can't. You know, people in elected, elected capacity, boy, they get a pass and give themselves a pass regularly. How is it that you're able, Jeff, to reconcile the whole do as I say, not as I do point on this?
Yeah, Abraham Lincoln did that in the Gettysburg Address in the Civil War. And what he said was, look, at the time, people were very used to slavery, of course, but also the laws made it really hard for people to free their slaves. So someone like Jefferson wasn't able to do it, even if he wanted to. But it was the idea of liberty for all people was put there for the future, Lincoln said. And so that it was supposed to guide the country going forward into the next generation. And Lincoln actually said, all honor to Jefferson for putting that phrase that you referenced, all men are created equal, in the Declaration of Independence.
It was the foundation for the progress that we've made. And that's what I keep turning to. You know, without that idea and that and our country's connection with that profound point that all men are created equal, then, you know, we might very well still have slave ownership here in the United States, for of all things. Jeff?
That's right. We see that in Lincoln's words, but, you know, we also see it in Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech from 1963, so famous and so known in our culture. He said that Jefferson and the other founders set up a promissory note, is what he called it, an IOU for the future to build on to make progress in this country.
Well, let me ask you this, Jeff Sakenga, expert on Thomas Jefferson and all things American history. Is the you mentioned on the idea that it made it that slave owners had an impediment to freeing them the way the laws were written. Can I ask you this? If I mean, they were considered chattel property. If Thomas Jefferson had released his slaves, you know, right there at the time, so I'm not going to own them, here they are, I'm freeing them. Is it possible that others would have taken those former slaves and made them their own slaves? I mean, what is the complicating factor here? Was he protecting them in some way by keeping them? I mean, that seems hard to swallow, Jeff.
It is hard to swallow, and it's not the path that someone like George Washington followed. George Washington was also a slaveholder, but he came to see that slavery was wrong, and he did eventually free his slaves in his will. But Washington knew that people who had been enslaved for many, many, many years would have a hard time adjusting to living in society, and society would have a hard time adjusting to them. So Washington actually set up a fund for his freed slaves to learn a trade, for the older folks to be cared for the younger kids to be cared for until they could learn a trade, to read and write, things that were very unusual in those days, because it's one thing to be declared free. It's another thing to actually be and live like a free person. And that's what Washington did. So we have one great example from our founding of someone who recognized the problems but really tried to deal with them.
Well, and then the other component of this, I guess I have to wonder, did Thomas Jefferson contemplate in the Declaration of Independence or in drafting the Constitution and the Bill of Rights and all of that, the framers, did they contemplate specifically freeing the slaves in the language?
They did. Jefferson wrote a paragraph in the original draft of the Declaration of Independence condemning the slave trade and slavery, but they had to get all the colonies to agree or the revolution wouldn't have worked. And two or three colonies said, we won't sign on to the Declaration if it has that paragraph attacking slavery in there. So out of compromise, they cut it.
Well, I think that demonstrates the mindset of Thomas Jefferson, not the cutting of it, but the fact that he would put it in there in the first place. See, obviously, this is a belief that he held.
It's so much so that by the beginning of the Civil War, people who had turned to defend slavery actually publicly attacked Jefferson for being anti-slavery. They said Thomas Jefferson is to blame for all this abolitionist agitation against slavery. So he was well known in his day and afterwards for being in principle against slavery, and a lot of people said he was inspiring the abolitionist cause. Hmm.
Jeff, it's a fascinating topic. I know you're going to go into detail tonight, and I want everybody to log in. Get your younger people to log in. This is something that high school age young people might find fascinating, but certainly it's important history, and it's important to keep everything in context because this has got to be frustrating for a historian like you, Jeff, that we as a society tend to view things from the current lens, how things are in modern times, the idea that, you know, racism is horrific and that, you know, the idea of owning another human being is just smacks with this, you know, our reaction is a normal, disgusted kind of thing. That wasn't the way people viewed things back then. Wrong, true, but it was the norm. And we don't take into account the way people perceive things at different points in time.
Yeah, we're going to try tonight in the class and as we go forward in this series, we're going to try and understand the past as it understood itself first, just so we can understand the way they thought and understood matters. And you know what? The way that we understand our founders is the way we Americans end up understanding ourselves. So this issue really matters for our country.
It really does, and it couldn't come at a better time. EmpowerUOhio.org is where you get the information for the seminar tonight. Thomas Jefferson, Saint or Sinner, by my guest this morning, Jeff Sakenga. Jeff, it was a real pleasure talking with you, and thanks again for conducting this seminar tonight.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Take care. 6:40 right now, 55 KRC, the time. It's 6:49 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station. Brian Thomas right here. Glad to have a producer named Joe Strecker, too. And I hope you again, you can get the EmpowerUOhio.org place, and there's all kinds of seminars, and it's a great semester. We talked with Dan Ragonold yesterday about the entire semester and some really great topics. EmpowerUOhio.org, and again, they're all free, and I think every single one of them is virtual, although they are opening the EmpowerU classroom back up sometime soon. Can't remember when Dan said that, but soon enough, you'll be able to go in person if you prefer to see these speakers live. And I prefer live, absolutely. The interaction is so much nicer and easier when you can engage and do a back and forth with whoever's teaching the class. Joe said, isn't it illegal? Isn't it illegal? And what? What are we talking about here? Michael Bloomberg raising money to help convicted felons register to vote in Florida. So Florida passed a law back in 2018. They reinstated the voting rights for felons. But in order to regain your voting right, which is taken away when you're convicted of a felony in Florida, you have to pay your fine. So if there's a fine, a fee, or any restitution, and this can go into the thousands of dollars, I'm certain. Say you're ordered 5 years in jail, and you must pay $10,000 in court costs, and you must, $100,000 in restitution, like you bilked someone out of the money. So whatever the fine, the monetary penalty associated with your conviction is, you have to discharge that, and then guess what? You get to vote again. So it's reported that Mayor Bloomberg and this Florida Rights Restoration Coalition have raised now more than $16 million to pay off, you heard me right there, pay off the obligations under this law. So the felons go to this Florida Rights Restoration Coalition, say, hey, I need $1,500 because that's what I owe to qualify for voting again, and they'll pay that off, this Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. And it's reported, I'm looking at the Hill's reporting on this, and I just, my stomach hurts when I read something like this. Apparently, television networks have also pledged to donate money to this organization. And, of course, they're trying. This is Florida now. They need all the Democrat voters they can get. So you got Mayor Bloomberg and this left-wing organization promising you that they're going to pay off this monetary penalty that there's no way you can pay. Right? Ah, geez, I'm never going to discharge that. I don't have the money. I don't have a job, whatever. Hey, here we are. We've got your money. We're going to restore your voting right. You don't think that goes along with a little suggestion that you might want to vote for Joe Biden or the Democrats in Florida, since we, the Democrats and the left-wingers, are responsible for paying off the penalty that you couldn't get out from under? And so Joe's like, isn't that illegal? And the answer is probably yes. Under Florida state constitution, convicted felons can regain their voting rights after serving their time. However, a law enacted by Ron DeSantis, Republican Governor DeSantis, says felons must pay all those fines. Under Florida law, it is also, a third-degree felony for someone to either directly or indirectly provide something of value to impact whether or not someone votes. That is the conclusion that House Judiciary Committee Matt Gaetz reached the other day. He's a Republican from Florida. And he pointed out that. He said, so the question is whether or not paying off someone's fines and legal obligations counts as something of value. And his conclusion is it clearly does. He went on to add, if Michael Bloomberg was offering to pay off people's credit card debt, you obviously would see value in that. And when you improve someone's net worth by eliminating their financial liabilities, that's something of value. Normally, it would be very difficult to prove that it was directly linked to impacting whether or not someone was going to vote. But they literally wrote their own admission. Washington Post reported a Bloomberg memo, quote, we know to win Florida, we will need to persuade, motivate, and add new votes to the Biden column. This means we need to explore all avenues for finding the needed votes when so many votes are already determined. The data shows that in Florida, black voters are unique, diverse, unlike any other voting bloc where the Democrat support, and here it is, Democratic support tends to be 90 to 95%. Now, they're bailing people out, or rather they're discharging the fees. These folks presumably are already out of jail. But does that suggest, since black voters are unique in Florida, according to Mike Bloomberg, and they're lockstep 90 to 95% Democrat? I wonder, and I'm just sort of wondering, and maybe you got a comment on this as well. Could a white guy get his fine discharged? Do you have to say you are a Democrat in order to qualify to have your fine paid for? You know those questions could be asked. somewhere along the line, or maybe nudge, nudge, wink, wink. You know, we here at the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition and Mayor Bloomberg want you to know that we're discharging this substantial amount of money and restoring your voting right. And it would be a good thing for you to consider staying lockstep with your brethren and voting Democrat. I'd say illegal? Oh, probably. Maybe Representative Matt Gaetz is on to something. Heck, he even pointed out, hell, there may be an investigation underway already of the Bloomberg collected connected activities in Florida. Get your popcorn out on that one. Dinesh, I know you got more to say than I could squeeze in a minute. If you want to hang on, we'll take you right out of the gate after the top of the hour news, but can't do it now. It's already 6:55 right now. 55 KRC, the talk station. We'll be back again after the news.
Following us on Twitter keeps you even more informed on local events than ever.
What's happening right now?
All the information is going to be revealed to us
at 55 KRC.
I always like the build-up. Wish we'd play the whole song. Happy Wednesday to you. Brian Thomas right here. We're going to get to Dinesh's phone call. He was kind enough to stay over the break. He's got a comment about COVID. Before we get to that, just remind you, Janice Hyes will be on the program. She is a local author. She's got a new book out, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader, Mary Jo Cropper, and Her Legacy of Hope. We'll hear from Janice at 7:40 on that one, followed by at 8:05, Ilya Shapiro, 1 hour from now, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. That's his book. Perfect timing on that one, given what's going on with Ruth Bader Ginsburg's passing. And, of course, Donald Trump's announcing on Saturday who he's going to name as his choice for the next Supreme Court justice. And hopefully it'll be over with in no time. I know Mitch McConnell's going to tee it up. Mitt Romney's not going to stand in the way anymore. He was one of the fence sitters. Of course, Rhino Romney, he's on board now. He's read his constitution. And he doesn't know, or rather care, I suppose, whether Ruth Bader Ginsburg's last words were, in fact, I want the next president to choose my successor. There's nothing in the Constitution. And even if she said that, and I suppose if he had time to Q&A her before she went on to her great reward, that you could say, well, does the Constitution provide for that? And since she swore to uphold the Constitution, I'm certain that she would have agreed it. No, it's just a wish, but, you know, I know the Constitution doesn't require you to take into account anything I said, which I suppose was the motive for Ted Cruz blocking a resolution the other day, objecting to her mentioning of her dying wish. Yeah, the Senate resolution failed to pass. It was a resolution honoring it's not honoring the death of Supreme Court Justice Ginsburg, and I suppose it's honoring Ruth Bader Ginsburg's life. Yeah, Ted Cruz objected to the Democrats trying to insert a line about her dying wish. The Democrats did not try to insert a line about Ruth Bader Ginsburg's position on packing the court, and she's reportedly said some years ago that, no, 9 seems to be a good number. It's been that way for a long time. So add that to the resolution and pass that one. Anyway, let's go to the phones as promised. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, pound 550 on AT&T phones. We'll get to Dinesh. Dinesh, thank you for holding over the break, my friend. Good to hear from you today.
Yes, Sam here, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. Brian, I'm just going to be touching something about the COVID reporting. So much data and information and news is floating around, and there's so much fear and doom and gloom that I went ahead and spent a lot of time in developing a report that brings down the curtain of this fear and confusion, and basically putting a handle on the information we have currently and not speculations. I created a report that divides the data of new deaths, total deaths of COVID, in 7 categories, starting from critical all the way down to safe, and brought it down to the daily and county levels. And it's amazing what a different picture we can create and share. So my reimagining the reporting process really helps administrators and public to put a handle on what they're seeing. And when I saw that, I really got excited because I'll just give you a quick summary. In the last, from August 15th, when I started working on this concept, 70 to 80% of our counties in Ohio have been in semi and safe zone, which means they're reporting less than four deaths or zero deaths, new deaths, because of COVID. So I began to look at the numbers of how many infections and all this fear and gloom information coming out really comes down to final stages. And there's a big difference. For example, in the universities in the U.S., they've reported 48,000 cases. Would you believe there was zero hospitalizations and only two deaths? So there's a big drastic difference in looking from that angle of the picture. So I followed Dr. Levitt's concept, is to look for a marker that is, even though it's doubtful at times because they are corrupted figures, they're putting everybody in the COVID death category.
Yeah.
That we can at least go with a handle and say, okay, let's go with a report. And we found a CDC report that comes out. And since August, they tried to come back and say, we have revised numbers. But finally, I have a report that just came out on September the 5th. That is showing a tremendous drop in the COVID infections. So the bottom line basically is that we need to stand up against these administrators and have them look at their guidances and remove a lot of these unconstitutional restrictions.
Well, yeah, and I would reach that same conclusion even if the figures were much worse than that. I mean, primarily because just because it may be the right thing to do, and I'll go back to I started the program off with the CDC coronavirus holiday celebrations guideline, right? You know, so you got Halloween coming up, so they have to issue edicts and mandates. They are guidelines, and it's recommended that you follow them. If you want to avoid getting the flu, you could probably follow these guidelines and achieve the same result. So they apply universally to breathing someone else's moisture-laden droplets, right? That's what we're trying to avoid because that's what's going to spread COVID-19. But even if the death figures were much higher, I would still say that these edicts and mandates are unconstitutional because they go way too far and they grab up and penalize or otherwise put people out of business who have no connection with coronavirus.
Exactly. I'm glad you mentioned that, Brian, because the yesterday's late CDC reversed that guidance.
Yeah.
You know, they said they put it out because they were under the pressure of WHO. Well, the doorbuster news came out from FDA. After over 200,000 people have died, they finally admitted that their staff does not have the training and the capacity to monitor the treatment information for COVID-19. So they are now looking for private sector help and giving them contracts to come up with ways to prevent the spread of the disease and treatments. That is shocking because of the trillions of dollars we spend with these agencies. They're now coming out and admitting to that.
Well, Dinesh, never let a good crisis go to waste. If they see an opportunity to have more funding coming into their departments and being able to hire more people, that's a way you grow government and more control, Dinesh, right?
That's right.
Yeah, it's inevitable. I can go back to my complaints about New York City Council passing rules after rule after rule to deal with the rules that they already have in place, which are an impediment to businesses actually staying open.
Exactly.
Welcome to reality.
That's right.
Dinesh, take care of yourself, man. Stay well. I appreciate the call. I like your calls, too. 749-5500, 800-823-TALK, or #550 on an AT&T phone. Yeah, the New York thing was hilarious. If you have a moment and you want to dive into the specifics, just check out the Wall Street Journal's article by Emma Tucker today. New York City Council introduces bills to aid restaurants in coronavirus recovery. And you think, okay, the genesis of all this is that you guys, in your broad brush approach to trying to control something that seems uncontrollable, have shut down legitimate businesses. And so we want to open them back up. One of the things they want to do is allow people to now have heaters, propane heaters outside where they're allowing bars and restaurants to serve customers. You can't serve anybody indoors until September 30th. And even then, they're only allowing 25% of the people. But with winter fast approaching, now they have to pass legislation that will allow currently prohibited propane heaters outdoors at restaurants. You think, well, why are they currently prohibited? I don't know. I guess it was probably global warming, one of these ridiculous knee-jerk reactions to global warming. But we have, I mean, propane heaters are ubiquitous. Head on over to the Home Depot, buy one. Put one pretty much anywhere. They seem to be rather harmless. But so you got the propane heater thing. Then apparently you have a regulation to deal with that requires the fire department to come over and make sure you have your propane heater set up properly. Permit for heating, which could take several months under normal circumstances. So here we got to pass another law to shorten the time frame for you to get a permit for the heater that we're allowing you to have, which are generally prohibited. There's like layer upon layer upon layer of stupidity built into all this. The COVID-19 relief fee that the council there passed to allow the restaurants to add 10% to the diner's bill. My only point on that one was, who in the hell, why is it the city council's position to tell restaurants whether or not they can charge an additional 10%? I mean, if you're owner of a restaurant, your hamburger there is 10 bucks and your cost of business goes up by 10%, you add another buck to the price of the hamburger. That's just what businesses do. I guess in New York, you can't do that. You need approval from council to add a COVID-19 relief fee rather than just adjusting the price of the meal. Two additional bills. Streamlining the process for restaurants to obtain a sidewalk cafe license. There's so many impediments to it, they have to pass a bill to streamline it. And introduction of a bill, low-interest small grants. And yeah, Americans with Disability Act has been on the books for a long time, but just one more method of government to micromanage your business. And this is not a slight to those who are suffering from a disability, but it was noted in this article, and it has been noted many times past, there's a lot of buildings that it is impossible or virtually impossible to retrofit. So you had your business there. I think a Scotty's downtown. I don't think that's a problem with retrofitting, but Scotty's, the restaurant, has been in business for over 100 years. Now, if you're in New York and you got one of these 100-plus-year-old buildings, you may not be able to complete the Americans with Disability Act retrofit. So there's an impediment to you. So now, given this COVID stuff, they're using that as an excuse to pass a bill that will allow small interest loans to small businesses and restaurants to bring them up to compliance with the Americans with Disabilities Act. Also, to allow them to update their ventilation equipment. Owner of Cat's Delicatessen was interviewed. His name's Jake Dell. One of the oldest restaurants in Manhattan. Said the permanent outdoor dining program would kind of help. Optional outdoor seating space. They're going to let these restaurants expand because there are rules in place that prohibited the expansion, I guess. He made a really good point. The reality is we have winter coming up. Making outdoor dining permanent is nice, but when we get to winter, it's not going to help anyone. Do you, as a consumer, want to eat outside when it's 20 degrees and snowing? It's a bit of a rhetorical question, isn't it, Jack? 749-5500-800-823-TALK. It's 7:23 right now, 55 KRC, the Talk Station. Happy Wednesday. It's made it even happier for me. I just got a smile on my face. Yesterday, Andrew Pappas, who's friends of mine on Facebook, anyway, that's the source of it, posted a little instant karma video. It's from a news source. It's actually on video. Otherwise, I thought it might have been a Babylon Bee article. But no, there's a lady flipping off Trump supporters. She's hanging out her window. And, of course, everybody's got a cell phone these days. So they're videoing this woman screaming and flipping the birds at Trump supporters. While doing that, she ran her car into the car in front of her. Interestingly enough, police were already there. So I call that instant karma. To the phones we go, 749-5500-800-823-TALK. Al, welcome to the program and a very happy Wednesday to you, sir.
Good morning, Brian. How are you this morning?
I'm well, man. I hope you can say the same.
Yeah. I agree with you. That's called instant karma.
Yes, it is.
Oh, hey, I just want to give you a call this morning. You know, it's Governor Beshear, as always, the COVID numbers. I've noticed where, you know, when it first came out, they wanted to make sure these high numbers were out there. And I notice now they're going to, he wants to talk about a new positivity rate. And it's interesting, the positivity rate, he says, you know, we got to stay under 4%. And I think after yesterday, we're back up at 4.5. But If you take the latest update, there's been, I think it's 1,152 deaths in the state of Kentucky, and there's 61,000, I think it's 572 cases. So, you know, the interesting thing, that's 0.018%.
Yeah.
And, you know, at what point are we going to tell them just to get the heck out of our way and let us get back to normal? You know, I told you before, I listen to you every morning. I work in Cincinnati, coming from Lexington every day. But I've noticed in stores now, like Walmart used to have the arrows down the floor telling you, you know, do not enter this way, walk the aisle this way, and had all these little areas set up that you had to go kind of in a corral to get into the stores.
Right.
I noticed now all those are gone. The arrows are up off the floor. It's kind of like they're to the point of saying, you know what, we're done with this.
Well, so, I think more and more of us are getting there, Al, and the statistics help us get there clearly. I think maybe the initial reaction was out of complete fear and concern. We didn't know anything about this virus. We saw what happened in China, where apparently it originated, and we freaked out. And we had hospital ships set up, and we had, you know, the convention centers converted into temporary hospitals and threw all kinds of gobs and gobs of cash at it for a surge that, fine, we were prepared for one, but it didn't show up. It didn't show up. So maybe we've learned something since then. And your statistics, I think, are consistent with many others who've crunched the numbers and determined that the death rate on this, as sad as any death is about the same as flu, or maybe not nearly as bad. But, you know, we're now at a greater point of education. And since we know more now and we feel a little bit more comfortable that we're not all going to drop dead, particularly those of us who do not have a comorbid condition. If you aren't struggling with some other health risk diagnosis, et cetera, then the likelihood, by all the reports that we have seen and read from, you know, from sources that can be trusted, suggest it probably will be a non-event. It may wipe you out for several days, and I've talked to people who have relatives that have had it, and, oh, yeah, wiped out for 3 days. Couldn't get up out of bed for 4 or 5 days. But never succumbed to any respiratory issues that required them to go to the hospital. Just a sickness. Yeah, maybe that's where we are, and maybe that's where we should be. Let people go back to work. Let these businesses survive, please. No one's going to force you to go into one, but at least give the restaurant operators and other businesses the freedom to make their choices, and let us have the freedom to make our choices. I think we'll make good ones. I think most people are willing to follow the guidelines. I went into a store yesterday. It said, must have a mask for service, and I didn't have my mask on. And as I got to the door, I looked at it, I'm like, okay. I turned around, walked back to my car, put my mask on, walked right on in. And who do I see? Somebody at the counter standing there getting service without a mask. So maybe they don't care in spite of what the sign says either. Rush Limbaugh Morning Update coming up next. It's 7:31 right now, 55 KRCD Talk Station. Local author coming up next. Looking forward to having her on the program, talking about a comforting light, which is a book about a cancer survivor and someone who knows a whole lot about it. So I'm looking forward to having that conversation coming up next. In the meantime, over to local stories. I'm not going to go through all the details, but we had a single student at University of Cincinnati complain to the Office of Equal Opportunity and Access. It's the entity that is responsible for looking into disciplinary actions against professors. One student got an email. One person, I guess multiple students got an email, but one person saw that the teacher, the professor, that has now been suspended, administrative leave without pay, referred to the coronavirus, COVID-19, as the Chinese virus. For students testing positive for the Chinese virus, I will give no grade. You can read the info I sent to the class, Ray, the torsion test, close quote. This is an engineering professor, I believe. Yeah, College of Engineering and Applied Sciences. So their hoo-ha over at the Office of, I guess, Reprogramming suspended him. And for saying Chinese virus. And I don't think it's inaccurate, but they accused him of being xenophobic. And I had to go back and ask Joe Strecker, because, you know, he's the one person I can bounce ideas off because I can see him here. Didn't it come from China? And I think the answer is clearly yes. I mean, unless someone comes up with other information, it may have gone from China to Europe, and then somebody from Europe who caught it flew to New York, but ultimately Wuhan province, right? We all learned that early on. Before any of us had any connection with COVID-19, people were dying in China. So it's not inaccurate to refer to it as the China virus, because it was from and based in China when it started. And there are many out there, including one scientist who's, I guess, been kicked out of the country or otherwise had to flee for her own life, who said the Chinese cooked it up in a lab. So whether or not that's true, I suppose history will let us know at some juncture. But they're getting rid of professors who would dare utter the words China virus. Where have we come? How have we gotten to this place? How have we gotten to this place? Indictment of participants in a local drug ring. This allegedly moved $2.8 million to the drug trafficking and money laundering, part of an international drug enforcement operation. You may have read about that. I had a story about that one. Huge darknet operation got busted. Operation Disruptor. T-O-R, and, you know, Disruptor, Disruptor, Tor, obviously for the Onion browser that folks use to maintain their anonymity and communicate on the darknet. Department of Justice said the operation resulted in 179 arrests, 121 of which were here in the United States, $6.5 million seized, 500 kilograms of drugs seized worldwide, and 274 kilograms of drugs seized here in the United States. So locally here, I guess we were part of it. Christopher Ray said in a statement, with the spike in opioid-related overdose death during COVID-19 pandemic, we recognize that today's announcement is important and timely. FBI will continue to use all investigative techniques and tools to identify and prosecute dark net opioid dealers, whether they or wherever they may be located. In Cincinnati here, five people were indicted as part of this group, operating under the names, oh, this is cute, Pill Cosby. And another one, Slang Gang. Federal indictments state the group began forming as early as 2013, dealing drugs in the darknet marketplaces with areas like Silk Road, Empire, Dream, Sleep, and Nightmare. And if you're familiar with those sites, then why are you there on the darknet surfing around those sites where they sell, yeah, drugs? Local indictees, Kalari Sorotkin, 36, of Colorado. Kelly Stephen, 32, of Colorado. Sean Deaver, 36, of Nevada. Abby Jones, 37, of Nevada. And Sasha Sorotkin, 32, of California. FBI estimates the group sold 33.9 kilograms of fentanyl in 5 months. And let that sink in. Fentanyl, the drug where like two tiny grains can be a lethal dose, in 5 months last year, they sold 33.9, call it 34 kilograms, 68 pounds. You just wonder where the consumption went. Anyhow, 736. They're not reporting overdose death numbers anymore. Do you notice that, Joe? Top of the hour news. You never hear how many people died of overdoses in the last, oh, I don't know, 6 months. Coming up, talking cancer. Let's do that with an uplifting book. Happy Wednesday. Brian Thomas here, 740 right now, 55 KRC Talk Station. Happy to welcome to the 55 KRC Morning Show a local author, Janice Heisel. She's got a brand new book, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader, Mary Jo Cropper, and Her Legacy of Hope. Janice, good to have you on the program. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on again, Brian. Nice talking with you.
Nice talking with you. And how many books have you written now?
Well, this is now my second book. My first book was about the Ryan Widmer case, and you probably remember what you and discussed that one.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I are you doing the Empower You seminar on that as well?
As a matter of fact, yes, I am.
Oh, great. What day? So we were talking about Empower You earlier. That we've got a, and I'm giving you an opportunity now on that springboard to recommend that folks log in tonight to empoweryouohio.org, where you'll also find the information about Janice's presentation on the Widmer case. But Jeffrey Sakenga is doing one on Thomas Jefferson tonight. And it should be fascinating. So empoweryouohio.org for that. And what day is your seminar on the Widmer case?
Off the top of my head, I don't remember.
That's okay.
It's in October.
That's okay, because we know we can go to empoweryouohio.org, and everybody's able to log in there from the comfort of their own home. And it's a virtual class, so you'll enjoy that. All right, on to your new book, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader, Mary Jo Cropper and Her Legacy of Hope. Who is Mary Jo Cropper, if I can be so bold as to ask the direct question that an entire book was written about?
Well, you know what? I actually did not know who Mary Jo Cropper was myself until her family approached me and told me her story and said that they felt like it was worthy of a book, and I agreed.
Huh.
Basically, Mary Jo, what's really interesting and cool about Mary Jo is that she grew up in a family here in Warren County that was, you know, pretty well known. Her dad was Ralph J. Stolle, he's the namesake of the Countryside YMCA up there in Lebanon.
Oh.
And that's a pretty well-known landmark for years up here. And he was an inventor and a businessman, but he was called the quiet philanthropist because he quietly went around and gave a bunch of people money, you know, out of the kindness of his heart. He had made a fortune through his various inventions, the most noteworthy one being the machinery used to manufacture pop tops on, like, soda cans, beer cans.
Oh,
sort of
no
thing.
Kidding.
Yeah, so it's like Mary Jo's story is kind of a slice of Warren County history along with her own biography. And so she lived kind of a low-profile life most of her life as a school teacher, a mom to two kids. Her son is Spencer Cropper, who is the chairman of Lebanon Citizens National Bank. You know, her daughter's Amy Winkler. And so they have deep roots here in Warren County.
Okay.
And so she went on to, unfortunately, be diagnosed with breast cancer. And then she started doing little presentations about her breast cancer and trying to help other people in small ways. But then she did something huge. She decided to give $1 million to form the Mary Jo Cropper Family Center for Breast Care at Bethesda North Hospital. So that's, in essence, her story.
So let me ask you, what period of time in history are you talking about? Because you're talking about, you know, a philanthropic family, and it sounds to me like this is these are years gone past. We're a long way from, you know, when she was diagnosed with cancer. Was she, a pioneer in bringing this type of thing to people's attention?
Well, actually, when she was first diagnosed, yes, in 1992, it wasn't talked about that much then. And the book addresses kind of the cultural changes that have happened where, you know, people have often talked about cancer kind of in hushed tones. In fact, her dad didn't even want to say the word cancer, even though he was benefiting cancer research with his funding. So I think that's kind of a very interesting aspect of the book.
Hmm. Well, and of course, the Cancer Center that she helped create and fund has obviously benefited many, many people over the years, and that's another lasting legacy she has. She's helped cancer, or she's helped people survive the disease.
Exactly. And as a matter of fact, that center, I just want to clarify, is not just for people who have cancer. It's actually for, you know, people who are getting routine examinations. And this is not just women. It's men, too, because men do make up 1% of breast cancer cases. A lot of people aren't aware of that. My book does actually include an interview with a male breast cancer survivor who did get his diagnosis at the Cropper Center.
Wow. Well, and it's an important reminder for folks to continue getting their regular checkups and seeing their physician a couple times a year because, you know, with this COVID-19 and the lockdown and everything, I know a lot of people have not been getting medical care. I hear this from doctors all the time. It's one of those layers and ripple problems that is out in the world that may manifest itself down the road with a lot of folks that otherwise could have survived with an earlier diagnosis. The idea that they're not going in and getting medical care because of COVID has prevented that diagnosis from even being made.
Yes, very true. The law of unintended consequences is definitely in play here. The things that have been done to try to help out with COVID have caused all kinds of other, as you say, ripple effects. And I like to say kind of almost like collateral damage.
Yeah. Well, back in the early 90s, I know that they had this now, I guess, completely debunked treatment. It was high-dose chemotherapy with autologous bone marrow transplant, and it killed a lot of women. Breast cancer obviously was the ultimate culprit, but this treatment was so, so damaging. And I just kind of wonder what Mary Jo's story is insofar as after she got diagnosed. Did she survive, or what happened?
Well, with Mary Jo, she did have a mastectomy when they first discovered the cancer, and then she decided voluntarily, which was a bit unusual in those days, to have a second one. And then from that point forward, she went along doing pretty well. She did go through chemotherapy and things. She went along doing pretty well for almost 10 years. And within the world of cancer, that's a long time. That's... And within the world of cancer treatment, it's almost like that, as I understand it, it's kind of a huge hallmark. If you reach that 10-year cancer-free point, then they think you might be quote-unquote cured or home free.
Yeah.
Well, in her case, literally a few months before that 10-year anniversary date, she said to her son, "My bones just hurt. Something isn't right."
Yeah.
She goes in, gets checked out, finds out that it's back with a vengeance, and
it metastasized. It was in her bones. It metastasized.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And she did live for quite a few years after that. Like, I believe it was 9 years before she did pass away in 2011. But thankfully, she did live to see the creation of the Mary Jo Center in 2009. That center opened its doors. And the story of how that center came about and how she was connected to it is really neat, because she had a very dear friend who also developed breast cancer. That friend received such great treatment at a fledgling little facility there at Bethesda North that Mary Jo really believed in this center, and another person connected her with the center also, and she decided to give this money, as well as developing an amazing friendship with the doctor who wrote the foreword to this book, Dr. Susan Weinberg, who became the co-founder of the much larger center.
Wow.
So it's kind of a neat story of interconnectedness with people, as well as Mary Jo's biography and that slice of Warren County history I referred to.
Well, and, you know, I'll go back to giving the gift of life through her contribution to the facility and providing, you know, an opportunity for really great doctors in our area to practice their medicine and help people survive. Name of the book, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader Mary Jo Cropper and Her Legacy of Hope. And the name suggests that this is an uplifting book, is it not, Janice?
Even though it was really hard for me to write the parts where, you know, I have to talk about her passing away.
Right.
I do leave it on an uplifting note and encourage people to follow her example, not just, you know, I don't care if you don't have that kind of money to give to a facility. As I mentioned in the book, you can, whether it's $1 or $1 million, or whether you just write a note to someone, which she was a prolific note writer. She actually was still writing notes to people who had any kind of cancer as she was pretty much, you know, in her final days. She was surrounded by post-it notes, one of her friends told me, about people she needed to contact to give them encouragement. And I don't want to underestimate the ripple effects of that.
Well, and there are lots of people in the world that, you know, take this kind of tragedy personally, and they ball up and wallow in, you know, their own pity and remorse and really let it really get the best of them. And then there are folks like this woman you wrote about, Mary Jo, and the Deathriches, Keith and Brooke Deathrich, who lost their daughter to pediatric brain cancer and started The Cure Starts Now and have raised millions of dollars for cancer research. So there can still be hope amid tragedy. And Janice, it's been a real pleasure talking with local author Janice Heisel. Get a copy of it. Go to my blog page, 55carec.com, A Comforting Light, Cancer Crusader, Mary Jo Cropper and Her Legacy of Hope. It's been a real pleasure, Janice.
Thank you so much, Brian. I do hope people will read the story and be inspired.
As do I. As do I. Thanks for writing. 7:54 coming up at 7:55, 55KRCD Talk Station. Yeah, it was good talking to Janice about that inspirational story, and just remind everyone, yeah, go see your doctor. I mean, you got problems, got to go see your doctor. And I've told people before, you know, I got diagnosed with cancer, and the only reason I ever got diagnosed is because I went to see my doctor, and something totally innocuous that you would think of nothing whatsoever. That's actually why I was there. Totally innocuous, nothing to do whatsoever with my diagnosis. The only reason I found out I had lymphoma was because, well, follow up. Dealt with the problem at hand, but you know, what else is this that you've got going on in your world, Brian? Why are your lymph nodes swollen? See, and there's the beginning. And then you get treatment. And there are great doctors out here in the greater Cincinnati area that can treat you for these horrific illnesses. But you have to take care of yourself. Get ahead of it. Earlier you get the diagnosis, the earlier they find it, the more likely it is you are going to survive. So just please take care of your health, please. 755, count on 756, 55 KRC, the talk station. Ilya Shapiro, Supreme Disorder, judicial nominations in the politics of America's highest court. That's next. Don't go away.
Stress is a good thing.
Sean Hannity.
Having to dig deep inside of yourself helps you to live a more full life.
Today after Rush on 55 KRC.
It's 8:05, coming up on 8:06 right now, 55 KRC, the talk station. Brian Thomas right here. Looking forward to the bottom of the hour, as we have every Wednesday. Judge Anna Napolitano joins the program, and we talk the law, which we're going to be doing, talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and the vacancy left on the Supreme Court. Perfect timing for my next guest, Ilya Shapiro, the director of the Robert A. Levy Center for Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute. Thumbs up for the Cato Institute. Prior to that, special assistant advisor to the multinational force in Iraq on rule of law issues, and I practiced at Patton, Boggs, and Cleary, a fellow lawyer he is. Co-author Religious Liberties for Corporations. I could go on all of the publications he has written for every major news outlet, has been on every single major media outlet, and a fellow member of the Federalist Society. Ilya Shapiro, welcome to the program, sir. It is a real distinct pleasure to have you on today.
Good to be here. You didn't mention the biggest thing, that I had a book come out yesterday, very timely, Supreme Disorder. Nominations in the Politics of America's Highest Court.
Ilya, you know that's what we're talking about today. I was just getting ready to say that because I wanted to introduce you first. Yes, a new book, and it is perfect timing, hot, as hot off the presses as a book can get. Released yesterday, and that's what we're talking about. Now, if you think about the problems in the Supreme Court nominations that we can recall freshly, the Gorsuch, the Kavanaugh one was particularly egregious, but you can go back all the way to Robert Bork, Clarence Thomas. One might conclude that that is a problem with the legislative branch, since they're the ones that bring up all the muck and rake and all of that. But you suggest that the problem actually is with the judicial branch. Ilya, can you elaborate on that?
Sure. It's basically jurist, heal thyself. For a long time, we've had a centralization of power in Washington, and within Washington, a skewing towards the executive branch, towards the administrative agencies that now write most of the rules by which we live, rather than congressional legislation. And each branch is at fault, but the judiciary has promoted its own self-corruption by allowing the skewing of power in this way, by warping federalism, warping the separation of powers, and therefore the Supreme Court has become so powerful. And so whatever reform proposals might be out there is kind of like rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The problem isn't with the process, it's with the product. The only way to reduce tensions over these vacancies is to make the seats less important, less powerful.
And how would one go about that? Because they made themselves powerful through judicial activism. You know, it's almost as if you can't get your way and what you want through the legislative branch, then you just run into court and claim a penumbra or a right that isn't written within the Constitution or the law, but you just suggest it's there, and magically a tax becomes a penalty or a penalty becomes a tax, even though it wasn't written that way.
Yeah, well, that's a problem of judicial theory, and we have to make sure to appoint the judges that will interpret the Constitution according to its original public meaning, interpret statutes according to their text and plain meaning. But that's the proper kind of debate to be had, you know, competing legal theories and, you know, what kind of judges do we want. But it's not going to happen overnight. I mean, it took us decades to get to where we are now. With continuing escalations in our judicial war, it's not going to be fixed overnight, whether in the current episode over the replacement of Ruth Bader Ginsburg or any other time in the near future.
But with the law, I mean, you know, I got to go back quite a few years from my law school years. It was 87 to 90. But back then, the concept of judicial conservatism and judicial activism were actually discussed. But I recall one of the professors, one of the more liberal ones, I might add, from my con law class, thinking that he articulated an argument that the Constitution itself contains a right to shelter and food and clothing. And I'm looking at it saying, no, that's not in there. Are they even teaching anything but judicial activism in colleges anymore?
Well, I mean, I don't like to use the term activism because everybody uses it just to say something they don't like. And the debate should not be over activism versus restraint. It should be about, you know, what is your interpretive theory, and let's debate that. Let's debate this idea that that the Constitution contains rights to food and shelter and health care and clothing and whatever else, positive rights, what philosophers call them.
Yes.
And I think that's obviously not the case. Law schools are pretty left wing, pretty progressive. I don't know whether they're more so. I graduated law school nearly 20 years ago, about 10 years after you, I guess. And it ebbs and flows, but the legal profession as a whole certainly has a tilt to the left. Some things have improved. I mean, at a certain point, they weren't even teaching the text of the Constitution in constitutional law classes. Justice Scalia had a big role to play in making sure that constitutional text was actually taught. There are different currents in legal education. But you're right. Part of that is a problem. Part of it is even before the students get into the law schools, whether K-12 or the colleges, civics education. There's a great hole. In our basic understandings of how the government works, what the Constitution's for, and all of that.
Well, and that's a great point. Then I was going to ask you. I mean, the liberals of the world, and I use the term loosely, but they seem to view the Constitution itself as an impediment to what they want. It's almost like, we're not going to teach it. We're not going to talk about separation of powers. We're not going to talk about the appropriate checks in government. All that is immaterial, you gun-toting, constitution-waving right-wingers out there. That's the way I perceive, and I have to go to judicial activism. That's just the way my brain works. But liberal justices and judges can overlook those limitations, like the 10th Amendment, Ilya. Whatever happened to the 10th Amendment? It seems to be very straightforward and clear, and yet look at our federal government.
Yeah, well, the 10th Amendment is kind of a belt and suspenders approach. It just says that the powers not granted here are reserved to the states and the people.
Yeah.
The 9th Amendment says that the rights, conversely, this is not an exhaustive list of our rights in the Bill of Rights. And so the 9th and 10th Amendments, as I said, they're kind of a redundancy in there. And I'm glad they were put in. Although, in general, I mean, this is not really new. The idea that the Constitution is an impediment to progress, that really started with Woodrow Wilson over 100 years ago. He had these what were then modern Germanic ideas of government administration, and these old Enlightenment-era 18th-century principles about checks and balances and the origin of our natural rights and things like this. That was definitely an inconvenience and outmoded, because the thinking was, well, we figured out what the right policies are. It's not a question of politics. It's a question of administration and technocrats just administering the rules that everyone knows are the way to go. So this is there's very little new under the sun. This did not start with the modern progressive era. Did not start with LBJ and the Great Society, FDR and the New Deal. Really, we're talking about coming out of the Industrial Revolution and the time when in Europe socialism and communism was brewing. And in this country, it was Woodrow Wilson's idea of progress.
Yeah, well, we all understand that Woodrow Wilson's idea of progress has brought us. But it seems to me one of the defining moments of federal power establishment and expansion was Wickard versus Filburn. The idea that you can grow tomatoes in your yard and somehow that affects interstate commerce when you and just your family are the only ones consuming tomatoes and nothing ever crosses state lines. Just the idea that you can impact interstate commerce through that loan activity, and that that gives the federal government power over all of us. Do you consider that to be one of the problems, Ilya?
Absolutely. Wickard versus Filburn was a case from 1942, and that's certainly one of the there was a number of years in the late 30s, starting in about 1937. That 5-year period there radically changed our constitutional order without any constitutional amendment, and did tremendous damage, both in terms of our understanding of the scope of federal power and how to interpret which rights to apply. Some rights are more equal than others. Did tremendous damage to our constitutional order, and we're reaping the whirlwind now, 80 years later.
Well, do you have any suggestions or solutions? I mean, I appreciate the very long, protracted history of how we got here from there, but is there really a way to reestablish the limitations? I focus on the federal government. It just seems to me the genie's out of the bottle. Ilya Shapiro, author of the book we're talking about today, Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court.
Well, yeah, I mean, it'll take a while. It'll take maybe another 80 decades. But civic education plus eventually appointing judges to try to rebalance that order and force Congress to legislate rather than pushing its powers to administrative agencies and not centralizing all of the policy decisions for a large and diverse society. There's no reason that California has to have the same healthcare policy as Texas, as Virginia, as Ohio, or any number of areas. There are things that are truly national, like national defense or actually interstate actual commerce.
Right.
But other things are like zoning. You know, there's no problem with Cincinnati having different zoning than New York or Miami. Well, there shouldn't be a problem with having different healthcare regimes or welfare policies or all these different things that we discuss.
Well, and you know, we're only just one justice away, at least historically speaking, one justice away from having rights eviscerated. I just think of the Heller case with the Second Amendment. Well, 5-4 case to start saying that, well, what's written there very clearly actually says what it says, and we do have the right to keep and bear arms. I mean, this is really, really important stuff, Ilya, and I wish more people paid attention to it. So perhaps your ideas about education reform and civics might help, although I think you're going to be facing an uphill battle in that regard because of the left-wing leaning education bodies we have to deal with. It just seems to be an insurmountable hurdle almost.
No, it's tough. Nobody promised you an easy ride down the down the garden path. Mixed metaphors.
You can get a copy of Ilya's book on my blog page. It's Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations, and the Politics of America's Highest Court. I strongly recommend it. Ilya, it's 55KRC.com, so my listeners know where to go to buy a book, copy of your book. I appreciate the time you spent with my listeners and me today, and keep fighting the good fight, my friend.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you.
Real pleasure. 8:17 right now. 8:22 right now, 55KRC Talk Station. Coming up, Judge Andrew Napolitano on Supreme Court nominees. And we'll get his opinion on whether or not we should move forward. Donald Trump's moving forward regardless of what Judge Napolitano says on Saturday. He's going to announce his pick. And, of course, Mitch McConnell and the senators, including now Mitt Romney, have agreed that they're going to go ahead and do the vote. Why? Because the Constitution doesn't have any exclusions or exceptions to dying wishes of Supreme Court justices. You may think it's the right noble thing to do to honor Ruth Bader Ginsburg's dying wish, but that would invite one more judicial activist on the bench, assuming Joe Biden wins or the Senate alternatively goes completely leftist in the upcoming election. An election we may not know much about, at least for several days. And important for me to mention this because the FBI and the U.S. cybersecurity agencies are now warning that, well, there are going to be foreign actors like the Russians, probably the Chinese, North Koreans, and pick somebody else who hates us, that are going to troll us. They're expecting the creation of new websites, the changing to existing websites, the creating and sharing and corresponding on social media, and spreading false information regarding the federal election. So you can prepare for it. You can already see it a million miles away because of COVID-19. Oh, how convenient. Everybody's going to be voting from home, voting from mail, voting by mail. No, a lot of people are going to go to the polls because, well, the people who are going to go to the polls and vote in person are the same people that go to the grocery store every week and get their groceries and realize that maybe this lockdown is a little too overstated or the problem has been overstated. Regardless, you can still wear a mask, go vote in person. It shouldn't be a problem. It never has been in the past, but that's not the way we view things now. We got mail-in voting. And the expansion of mail-in voting. If you look at speaking of judicial activism, the decisions out of Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, ignoring what the law actually says, must be postmarked and turned in by November 3rd, and then creating additional windows of opportunity that you're going to have to count votes that show up 2 weeks later. Where in the hell was that written? What law was passed that said 2 additional weeks need to be granted? It wasn't. Some judge just thunk it up. So because of those delays, you know, you're not going to know right away. And these are swing states we're talking about. It's going to be a couple of days, maybe a week or two. Unless it's a landslide victory for one side or the other, this is going to be a while. And so during that period of time, the confusion will set in, and the trolls from all over the planet will be talking about voter suppression and voter fraud and faulty and hacked systems, and most of it's going to be a bunch of crap. Hopefully, anyway. Cooler heads can prevail as long as there are enough cooler heads out there that don't get apoplectic after the election because, well, there's a bunch of trolls out in the world ginning things up and trying to divide us further. And if you're part of that group, you're going to be dividing us further. You've been trolled. You've been had. You are a useful idiot. Do anything to better the society in which we live. Find some common ground with your fellow Americans. Starting point is common ground. You're going to find you can make a friend in someone. If you're starting from a point of division, it's not going to happen. 825 right now. Coming up, Judge Ann Napolitano, after I mentioned Your Wellness Center. Hormone replacement therapy from Your Wellness. 829 right now, 55 Care CD Talk Station. Everybody's tuning in because they know at this time of day it's Judge Ann Napolitano on a Wednesday at 8:30. Welcome back, Your Honor. It's always a real pleasure having you on.
The pleasure is mine as well, Brian. How are you, my dear friend?
I'm doing really well. Doing really well. Do you know Ilya Shapiro, the director of the Robert Levy Center of Constitutional Studies at Cato?
I do.
Just talk to him.
Gifted legal scholar.
Just talk to him. He's got a new book out. It's called Supreme Disorder, Judicial Nominations and the Politics of America's Highest Court. Talking about how the problems that we face, the idea that Kavanaugh would be drugged through the mud. You can go all the way back to Bork. You can look at the Merrick Garland situation. And he said this problem precedes all of this, and it's not the fault of the legislative branch necessarily. It's the judicial branch's problem of its own making because of what I characterize as activism. But the powers that they have ultimately given themselves, almost as a legislative branch anymore, and that's why these things are so unbelievably critical. He thinks we need a refocusing of the judiciary and a return to some normalcy, at least in terms of more conservative-minded justices not taking such an activist role over our lives.
Well, I agree with him, and I know him very well. You know, I am just finishing up. It's taken me 4 years to write this, a 550-page, 1,600-footnote treatise on the natural law. Now, before you can go to an academic publisher, you have to endure peer review, which is about 25 of your academic peers grilling the daylights out of you. One of those 25 was Ilya, and even though he agrees with 99% of what is in this book, he went for my jugular. But it was a happy 8 hours, and I survived, and the book survived. He studies the Constitution as I do. He studies it full time. And I agree with him. Now, some of what we see today is tit for tat.
Yeah.
The Democrats did this to Bork. The Republicans are going to do it to whoever. Bork, Thomas, Kavanaugh, and now probably whoever this nominee is. But he is right. The court has almost become a super legislature. If President Trump succeeds in getting whoever his nominee is seated before Election Day, and if Joe Biden wins, and if the Democrats take the Senate, that's three ifs, you're going to see more tit for tat. You're going to see the Congress try to do things to change the makeup of the court, to reduce its jurisdiction. If they add people to the court, and then 5 years later, if the Republicans are in power and they add people to the court will lose its respectability. It will just become a super legislature whose makeup is filled by whatever political powers control the White House and the Senate. And that's not right.
No.
I believe this started with Roe versus Wade, where they wrote their own law and set their own standards, and none of it was based on the Constitution, and we're still suffering from that today.
Yeah, and you know,
there was a time when justices were just put on the court. Somebody died on a Monday, the replacement was on Tuesday. There was also a time Justice William Brennan, who was a former member of the same court that I was a member of in New Jersey, was appointed by President Eisenhower in a trial period. He did so well after 6 months, there was no need for a hearing. The Senate confirmed him. So what we've seen with Bork and Thomas and Kavanaugh is a modern phenomenon that doesn't seem to be getting better. It seems to be getting worse.
Much worse, much worse. Well, and the idea, though, that they're screaming about Trump moving forward with this pick, I guess is going to happen on Saturday, and they may have a tough row to hoe since he's allegedly going to pick a woman. They're going to have the sexual harassment allegations to blow around, at least I presume so, but we'll wait and see what the attack is. But there's no Ruth Bader Ginsburg or dying wish exception within the Constitution. It's the president making a recommendation with the advice and consent of Senate. That's it, right? There's
yes.
No presidential election,
I mean, there
year exception.
There are these nuances. I thought 3.5 years ago that the Senate treated Judge Garland very shabbily. They had the votes to defeat him. They should have held a hearing and defeated him rather than refusing to hold the hearing. And Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham, I know them both well on a first-name basis, sound like hypocrites today. However, there is no constitutional or legal impediment to the president nominating a successor at any time. He could nominate the successor on January 18th before he leaves office. And there's no constitutional impediment or legal impediment to the Senate taking up that nomination at any time.
Now, and you make a very good point in response to this argument that's, you know, the Republicans, you know, played fast and loose last time. The good point is, and I tried to remind people of this all week, which is the Senate was controlled by Republicans at the time. The presidency was obviously Democrat. They would have, had they voted on it, defeated him. They could have said no Merrick Garland, and that would have been the end of it. And had they done that, you wouldn't have this, oh, you did it this way last time, and you should be doing it the same way this time. The circumstances are
correct.
Different.
Correct. You know, Lindsey Graham's an interesting person here. Now he's chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. He has said he voted to confirm Ruth Bader Ginsburg, by the way, a very conservative Republican voting to confirm a notorious progressive liberal Democrat, because his view is the choice is the president's and the Senate should confirm as long as the person is basically qualified. So that's one of the reasons I think that they never took the vote on Merrick Garland. Was he basically qualified? Of course he was. He had been a federal prosecutor for 25 years and a federal appeals court judge for 15 years. He was the most conservative judicial nominee to the Supreme Court offered by a Democratic president since FDR nominated Robert Jackson, his sitting attorney general, to the court. But Lindsey Graham didn't want to be forced to vote yes or no. So he persuaded the powers to be to relieve him of the obligation to vote.
And get pick your brain on the whole idea of this identity politics and the Supreme Court nominees. I mean, Donald Trump said he's going to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg with a woman, and I guess that's the tit for the what you do, the, you know, consistency. But Joe Biden is promising an African American woman. Now, he won't mention anybody's name, and I think that's his problem for his campaign. But this idea that the color of one's skin or one's gender has an impact on or somehow is important for the interpretation of the law, I find that a little bit troubling. Just wanted to gauge your reaction on that.
I agree with you. And look, you'll know immediately if Donald Trump is playing this game as well. If he nominates Judge Barrett from the Seventh Circuit, that's who his favorite has been all along. She doesn't bring him any votes that he doesn't already have. If he nominates Judge Lagoa from the 11th Circuit, Cuban-American, who ran for office and was elected in Florida and is immensely popular in the Cuban-American community in Florida, then you're going to see politics playing the fine hand, because without Florida's electoral votes, President Trump's path to the nomination is very, very narrow, and he is presently consistently losing in all the polls in Florida. So does politics play a role? Yes. Should it? There's no way to keep it out. Presidents really should be thinking about judicial philosophy and not their own reelection. But presidents are human beings.
They are.
The idea of saying ahead of time who's on the list, I mean, that was devised by President Trump. No one has ever done that before, and Joe Biden has not fallen for that. In fact, the two nominees this time around weren't even on his list. Just they added them recently to say that they had been on the list.
Well, I guess he could have seen the writing on the wall that he was going to have to replace a woman with a woman. So
listen, the other day he said on Fox and Friends, I have a very bright 70-year-old friend who ought to be on the court, but I'm looking for people that are younger. I wonder who he was talking about. You have to mention the age.
Judge Napolitano. It is so much fun having you on this show. I thought one of the highlights of my week, my friend.
Same here, Brian. All the best until next week.
Yes, indeed.
By the way, I was just given the assignment of working all night on election night. No sleep. In front of the camera all night from 8 p.m. to 8 a.m.
Wow. Well, in that regard, Your Honor, if I had to do that assignment, honestly, I'd much rather be in the comfort and convenience of my own home having to do it than stuck at a studio for that long. So I view that as a plus.
Right.
Find the pluses where you can. Your Honor, stay well until next week.
All the best. Until next week, Brian.
Take care. 839 right now, 55KRC, the talk station. Opportunity for me to mention Fasten Pro. I love those folks at Fasten Pro Roofing. Because they're great people. You know, Ray Matre served his country in the Navy, and he joined up with Amanda Weaver. And for more than 20 years, I think he's like 22 now, they've been together, and they, well, have a fantastic. 8:46, the 55KRC, the talk station. Appropriately timed theme song there for my next guest, Patrick Kanan. Patrick, welcome to the program. I understand you are one of the family owners of the Grub Pub in Hamilton.
That is correct.
And I understand also, and I'm on your side of the equation, at least I think I am, because you received a citation for violating these nonsensical health orders, most notably Governor DeWine, and I've been critical of this because apparently Governor DeWine, in his infinite wisdom, believes that, well, if you quit drinking, or rather serving alcohol past 10 o'clock and you close a bar at 11, that somehow that's magically going to make coronavirus go away. Now, do you have any feelings with regard to that specific item, Patrick, before we dive on into what happened to you?
You know, personally, the coronavirus is bad.
Yes.
With certain people. But, you know, the hospitalizations and the deaths have went way down.
Yep.
In the beginning, they were worried we were going to overrun the hospitals. They took the Duke Energy Center and set beds up and everything. And, you know, it never happened. And it's getting, you know, we're building an immunity to it, and the virus is getting weaker, yet we're still enforcing these crazy rules.
Draconian they are. But you see, my biggest problem with them, if they were actually designed to accomplish something, and I find it a little hard to believe, and no one has been able to provide me with a legitimate argument in favor of stopping alcohol sales at 10, meaning at 10:01, magically it becomes a more dangerous time frame. But that, you know, but drinking prior to and up till 10 in no way, shape, or form represents a problem. It's just, it's arbitrary. It's capricious. You got caught up in it. You got a citation.
The one other thing, you know, a lot of times people don't look at it from a common sense view. Down in Florida, they close the beaches except for like 4 hours a day, 5 hours. How does that make sense? Now your beach is going to be really crowded for those 5 hours.
No.
Open that beach all day long. Close one door at Walmart. Now we're squeezing everybody through one door at Walmart instead of spreading everybody out.
I mean,
a lot of times their rules are making us more compact. Shrinking the bar hours, now more people's going to try and get their drinking in.
Indeed. And of course, the rules, crazy as they are, and you make a good point there. Obviously, you're a man of logic and reason, my friend. They also put people out of business. And of course, curtailing your income flow, I'm sure, has been hard, a hurt to your family. The Grub Pub. Now, are you open now? Is this administrative citation they gave you prevent your bar from being open?
No, we can continue to operate. We will probably have a Department of Liquor Court hearing in November is what I'm gathering. Little history on my bar.
Please.
My family has owned this bar for 39 years. My mom purchased it when I was in 11th grade of high school. And we have run what we consider a very good, clean business for 39 years. We're open 365 days a year. We don't have a menu, food, but we do serve like we're open Christmas Day. We have dinners then for people that don't have anywhere to go. We're open Thanksgiving Day, and we provide food for those. Every Sunday, we give pizzas away for people to come in and watch football or baseball or something. We spend $50,000 a year on live entertainment for the music industry to help them and to provide great entertainment. The bar over those 39 years has had one citation that was because of a bartender that did something that we had no control of, and she just got hired. So right. The bar has run a very clean business.
So you, in all of those years, you have no problems whatsoever. And I'm not even going to hold that other one against you. Of course, Patrick, that wasn't your fault. Completely free. So under any other circumstances, the health department that came in and issued you a citation, they couldn't have found anything wrong. Your license couldn't have been pulled. There was nothing that they could hang their hat on to be critical of Grubhub in Hamilton.
Correct. And it wasn't the health department, though. City of Hamilton Police Department are very supportive of us. If I have any problems, then call them. They are right on the spot.
Yeah.
They help us a whole lot. This was the governor's task force that showed up. And, you know, shutting the bars down, they want to do it to stop the spread of corona. And the governor says every time, wear your mask, wear your mask. And their task force did not.
Oh, ho, ho, ho. Patrick, you might want to point that out when you're in front of the Ohio Liquor Control Commission for this hearing. Have you got a lawyer and you're going to fight this thing, Patrick? Because my argument all along, and so many people have been going to court and making this, is if you're going to interfere with our freedoms, and this certainly does, it's interfering with your contractual relationships, it's interfering with your business, your income revenue stream, it's arbitrary, it flies against the face of the regular business hours, all of this, these are great reasons to point out to a judge, for example, that it has exceeded his authority. The governor does not have the legal authority to quarantine or otherwise impact healthy people. And that's a winning argument in court. So far, I think about five courts in Ohio have erred on the side of or come down on the side of the businesses. So my question, long way of getting to it, you got a lawyer to fight this thing, Patrick?
We do not have a lawyer at this time yet. However, see, our problem would be we will be in front of the liquor board, not
I understand.
Judge.
I understand. But see, the citation springs from something the governor randomly pulled from his sphincter, which is 10 o'clock, after which no alcohol can be served. And you were cited for serving alcohol after 10. If he doesn't have the authority to tell people that, which I argue he does not have the legal authority, then the Ohio Liquor Commission can't do anything but let you go. That's my view.
Right. And here's another problem for Ohioans. You know, they're always wanting to help Ohioans. Well, now all the customers, especially in border towns like Cincinnati, well, Kentucky can serve till 11. So now they're either just planning on spending their evening in Kentucky, or they have a mass exodus over there at 10 o'clock.
Yeah.
Indiana can continue to serve till 3 a.m.
Doesn't sound right, does it, Patrick? If people are going to just pack up their bags,
really
go there.
Hurting Ohio people, you know, on bordering towns.
Well, I hope that someone or you makes this plea to the Ohio Liquor Control Commission, because I still go back to the fact that, you know, legally speaking, I am convinced, and I know I'm right on this, that if the governor doesn't have the authority to pick the hour at which alcohol can or cannot be served, then they can't cite you for violating that particular thing. And I would make that argument to the Liquor Control Commission. When are you going to be in front of the Liquor Control Commission?
We haven't received our letter yet of the date. And the other bad part is, you know, we purchased a license that was a 230, 7 days a week license.
Ooh.
For a lot of money. Well,
ooh,
we were shut down for 2 months. And now you've cut our hours on the main revenue earning time. And, you know, there is no rebate on that $3,000 liquor license.
I think you could make an argument that there should be. Class action lawsuit. All folks similarly situated who have been deprived the value of a license, which gives them specific operating hours, only to be arbitrarily interfered with by the governor. You owe me some money back. Let's prorate that $3,000 down to something that fits in with these random hours you assigned. Patrick, you got some good arguments on your side. I'm going to encourage now Grubhub. That's open to the public. You want to encourage people to show up there, Patrick?
Oh, come in, help us, support us. We need the revenue in, and, you know, support all the local bars.
Yes,
because we're luckily in a position that, you know, I'm a retired public employee. My mom is older and was also a real estate agent. But these bars, if that is their only income, really need help. They really do.
47 Hancock Avenue, if the Enquirer's got the reporting right, that's where you'll find the Grubhub. Support Patrick Kanan and his family. Show up there. Get a nice cold beer and enjoy yourself. Just make sure you do
coldest,
it before.
Coldest, cheapest beer in town.
Coldest, cheapest. That's a bold statement, Patrick. Hope you can stand by it. I'm sure you can. And I wish you the best of luck for the Liquor Control Commission, and I hope that they come down on the side of what is right and lawful and just throw that thing in the garbage can, my friend. Great talking to you today.
Thank you for your time, and thank you for putting us out there. I appreciate it so much.
A real pleasure, my friend. The Grub Pub, 47 Hancock Avenue. I think it's worth you guys stopping in there and grabbing a beer. Good guy. 855 right now.